driven away now from Cantley Hill Plantation, and we're in this wonderful avenue of hedges that Chris has created, just driving through there, and it zigzags through a couple of the larger fields here. And you must be absolutely chuffed about how well this is taken.
Yes, they were planted in 2007, and we put in 23,800 hedging plants, so it's a major part of the HLS, the Higher Level Stewardship Scheme. And we had a lovely wet spring that year, and so we had 98% success rate in planting. And they've still got many of the little tree guards on. The planting brigade that did most of the work were a little bit concerned about the number of rabbits here, and they said they would either nibble them all off if they didn't put the spiral guards around them, and they did. And they are meant to be sort of soluble and eventually disappear. But there's a whole mixture of British native species. So we've got hazel right beside us, blackthorn springing out from the bottom of the hedges, lots of hawthorn, field maple, and dotted all the way through, hazel as well. So lots of British natives. And then on the margins, which are not cut, we've got a lovely display of speedwell, bright, bright blue, sort of closely related to forget-me-not plants which you grow in your garden. And really, really good. And all the way down here, on the other side of the hedge, is an uncut, very wide margin. And when I walk down here each evening with Rat to kind of finish the day off, my demented terrier, there's some yellowhammer singing. So we've planted oak trees every 40 or 50 metres down the hedgerows, quite a number further down there, just coming up nicely now. They're about 12, 15 feet tall. And it's just coming along really beautifully as a sort of it's an old roadway, really, from years ago. The first part of it, the existing hedge was still there, and it's on the map that I have of the farm from 1640. So some of the old hedgerows are really, really old and feature prominently in the Norfolk landscape. And then we come all the way down here. It goes from Caister to Arminghall, and it's shaped like a Z, the hedges, so it's not a big straight run, and it's absolutely fabulous for all sorts of butterfly species. So in future week I hope to bring you here and show you another species of butterfly. We started off this podcast with the holly blue, and there's a really interesting butterfly. It's almost unique, really, in that when it closes its wings, it's iridescent green. So when it lands in the hedge, you've got to see them flying, and fortunately they're brown on the upper side of the wings. So you're actually looking for a brown butterfly, which changes by magic to iridescent green. And my local moth expert, Dave Jones, has managed to photograph them down this hedgerow, and they're just stunning. And you then start to realise what real biodiversity is all about, where you have as many species in a particular area that it can actually comfortably support. So we go from gravel, sands, clay, and so when you look behind you, Matthew, you can see the rabbits have decided that the sand is easy digging, and they've scrambled out quite a lot of sand from underneath the hedge, which is set up on a quite a high bank at that point.
You have had fox's earth in there before, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, and little owls in there as well. So foxes have been in there. And it's quite typical out on High Ash Farm that you cohabit. You have lots of rabbits in a warren, and the foxes that live in the warren kind of ignore the rabbits. It's really odd. And you'll see the vixen or the dog fox just stroll off, and the cubs will play, and the rabbits don't pay a blind bit of attention to them. I've seen it as well with the mammal, the fabulous mammal that we looked at last week, which was the stoat. And I've seen stoats sort of going through almost a flock of rabbits and not paying a blind bit of attention to them, and then half an hour later you see the stoat bringing one back and right past the rabbits that are laying there. Anyway, it's question time, Matthew.
Yes, and the emails are blowing away in the very slight breeze we've got
there
here.
Is, but it has turned a lot milder, so it's not quite shirt sleeve weather, but nonetheless. And of course, Mr. Rat has to chip in, so I'm going to pick him up and hope we don't get revisited with the military jets.
Tina says, this blustery morning we visited Worstead Church in North Norfolk. Originally, that was the home of Worstead Wall.
Yes, of course, yes.
Looking for a relative's gravestone, we were. As an absolute treat, swifts were soaring through the skies and the village. This made my day.
Yep, I was so lucky. And if you know what to look out for, if you were actually looking for a gravestone, you were probably looking downwards, but when you sort of look up at the sky and see the first swifts arriving, average arrival date in the UK is about the 15th of May, so they're a little bit late this year, but some people, particularly in the centre of Norwich, they're being seen in Swaffham and Wyndham, just a few miles away from where we are. There's been quite large numbers there, but last year at High Ash Farm, we were in the hundreds of swifts, and in previous years we've had flocks of over 1,000 simultaneously feeding over the wildbird seed mix when it comes into flower, and we have the pollen beetles swarming off the crops and the swifts come and hoover them up, but far fewer numbers last year.
Tina says she loved hearing about last week's stoat, and she came along, I think, during the week, didn't she, with some friends, with a Finch's friend swift box.
Yeah, right.
Should you like to place it at the farm?
Yes.
But, were you around?
Yes, it has arrived, and it's sort of nest box week, because the local men's shed club has made me a dozen boxes, tawny owl boxes, barn owl boxes, swift boxes, and so I'm going to treat those with water repellent paints, and then they'll go up over the next few weeks. And thank you everybody, and particularly Tina, for her addition as well.
And here's one from the United States, Andy Olcott. Greetings, he says, from Glenview, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. I love your podcast, Chris, and listen to your old shows on BBC as well. Thanks so much. We live right next to a forest preserve that has picnic pavilions and swallows nest in them. I've become more interested in them because of your show. My wife and I go there around dusk and we watch the swallows feed and bring insects back to their brood. It's really wonderful.
Oh, thank you very much for that. Yeah, it's quite surprising what you can learn just watching. And he sent a brilliant photograph of two of the adult swallows. They do look like the swallows we have here in the UK, which we call barn swallows, but across the world, swallows are quite a widespread species, and they have lots of different, very close relatives as well. Sometimes we get them sort of vagrants arriving in the UK, and it causes a bit of excitement.
Our UK swallows will come up and down from Africa every
year.
Yes,
they will. Yes.
These ones go up and down the Americas, don't they?
Yes, they do. They can go right down to South America, and the migration of some of the species is equally as long. Ours do a cool 5,000 miles from Johannesburg, right down in South Africa, up here to the UK, and similar distances down in America there. And the nest, the cup nest, is very, very similar. And you can actually see the individual mud pellets there in the nest that the adults have brought back. But that's one thing we're short of here at High Ash Farm this year, and that's mud for nest building. So
lack of rain.
Well, yes, just pure lack of rain. We've hardly had 10 millimetres in the whole of March and May now, and it's been a very dry month to this point in time.
One of the most delightful and evocative sounds of the English countryside, Chris, the song thrush.
Yes, it's one of the success stories here at the farm. We've got quite a number of them nesting here, and it's one of the UK's most competent songsters singing away for us.
Just one of the sounds that you can hear regularly on this podcast.
And we've got a little favour to ask. If you can possibly help by sending us a donation to help support the running costs of the podcast by visiting highashfarm.com/podcast.
And thank you for all your donations. Elspeth, greetings to you. Thanks for your email. We went to Brockholes Nature Reserve in Lancashire. We saw some small insects jumping and skimming over the surface of the water. Some were seemingly chasing each other. They looked to be silver in colour, about the size of a grain of rice. Do you know what they were?
Oh, absolutely. One of my most favourite tiny, tiny insects. The silver colour is actually an apparition. They're tiny black beetles, but the silver bit that you actually witnessed is all the air that's trapped in microscopic hairs all around the periphery of the little tiny insects. The common name of them are whirligig beetles, and they go round at great speed on the surface of the water. It's actually really amusing to watch them. They do circles and cause a little ripple of water, particularly on smooth, still water. And they form little groups at this time of the year. This is their mating season. Normally have them in a little pond halfway up this track here, and the pond is bone dry. But if we got substantial rain, it would refill and the whirligig beetles arrive. Now, fascinating. Why are they fascinating? Because their eyes are level with the surface of the water. Right, nothing unusual about that. But the eye is divided across the middle of the eye, so they can see above the water with the top half of the eye, and they can see underwater with the bottom half of the eye. Just absolutely amazing. And they go across on this little cushion of air, rather like an invisible hovercraft, and their legs are kind of divided like an oar is. So when they go on the backstroke, the oar goes sideways, it flicks across, and they can get up quite a speed. And on the forward stroke, it switches direction and becomes very narrow and comes back towards the front of the body. Absolutely amazing. But if you scaled that insect speed up, it does about nearly a mile an hour on the water surface, because they're so tiny. If you did it in human terms, forget Donald Campbell's bluebird boat. They do 280 kilometres an hour is the speed they get to.
Whoa.
Absolutely amazing. So now, there's fascinated people for centuries almost. And there's a poet called Hilaire Belloc, and she's sort of penned a little ditty about them, which I love. And it's got a moral to it, and the moral is don't ask questions. And it goes like this. The water beetle here shall teach a sermon far beyond your reach. He flabbergasts the human race by gliding on the water's face. But if he ever stop to think of how he did it, he would sink. I love it.
Hilaire Belloc.
Yes, yes.
Fabulous.
So just incredible. So it's always surprising, these little tiny things you see out in the countryside sometimes have a fascinating history.
Julian McElroy, I witnessed something interesting in our Kent garden. A squirrel sitting on top of a nesting box, which is occupied by house sparrows. The male sparrow was not amused and flew at the squirrel, hitting it square on the back of the head. The squirrel ran off. Sparrow 1, squirrel 0.
I love it, yes. So you do see, when you watch wildlife, particularly if you've got bird feeders or nesting boxes, over the course of the season, you'll always see something which almost takes your breath away, and that's sheer sort of, I don't know what word to use, it's either stupidity of the sparrow or pure brazen fury.
Some great photographs here from Dave Barton of a waterway there in Dartmouth.
Dartmoor.
Of course, Dartmouth is where the water runs out, isn't it, into the sea. I originally found you when I was looking for information on the Gambia. Well, I know you're a well-recognised authority on the Gambia, Chris. But he goes on to say, I'm an avid amateur photographer and birder. I was sitting on a rock in the River Plym on Dartmoor, spending time with a colony of sand martins. They're just enthralling, a joy to watch, but a challenge to get a picture. But with perseverance and luck, I managed to get a few, and he's sent them.
He certainly has, and all I can say is, wow. And this is exactly what Matthew and I looked at, but from beneath, because we visited a local sand quarry right on the edge of High Ash Farm about three podcasts ago, and we saw these very birds. You are so spoiled. But the question for me is, because that's quite a fast-flowing river with rocks and things, I wonder locally where they're nesting. Yes, so is there a kind of sand face nearby? So there we are. Thank you very much for that stunning picture. It must have taken you hours to get that. Well done.
And before anyone writes in, yes, the River Plym comes out of Plymouth.
Yes.
The River Dart comes out of Dartmouth.
Yes, yeah, and the River Tass comes out at Yarmouth.
Yeah, but in Norfolk, we...
It's Yarmouth.
We do different, don't we, here? And just one last one. You mentioned Heston Bales last week, and Kathleen would like you to explain more about what is a Heston Bale and compare them to other forms of bales that you will use for straw and hay here.
Yes, it is quite interesting how things have changed. If you notice my arms, they're rather like tree trunks, and that's from pitching straw bales. Everything was baled at the end of harvest each year, and together with the hay, and we didn't have such a thing as the very large balers which are available today. So everything was done by hand, and the kind of maximum weight you could comfortably lift time after time after time to load the trailers up would have been a 25 kilo bale, which is about a quarter of a hundred weight, no, half a hundred weight. And they're called conventional bales. And in small farms, and particularly in livestock areas, a lot of baling is still done with these tiny bales, which you can pick up. They have two strings around them, and they're usually about 3 feet long and perhaps 18 inches square on the end.
Still hard work, though.
Incredibly hard work. They can be, you know, they have to be hand-moved. You can have little pallets of them, then they come out of the back of the baler. You can have what we call a sledge, and that gathers them into groups of 8 or 10. And I must have actually loaded tens of thousands of them over my early farming career. Then things moved on a little bit, and we moved from 25 kilos to between 100 and 250 kilos, and they then became round bales from about 4 foot diameter and up to 6 foot diameter. They're still used today, and they're either wrapped in string, which the early ones were, 3 or 4 or 5 strings all the way around the perimeter of the bale, and they can either be wrapped or then sort of stored, but they're not very efficient in the barn because you have big gaps between them, as opposed to the conventional bales. And then the ones we're now going to move on to are Heston bales. You can have small Hestons, which are 2 foot on each end, 2 foot by 2 foot, and these are 3 or 4 foot long. So in metric, it'd be 600 by 600 by 1,000 millimetres long. And they go up to about 200 kilos. And you can actually, in soil, hay and straw as well in huge bulk areas, and then you run a tractor over it to get the aero and then cover it with a sheet. But then what's now happened is a whole new range of balers called HD balers, high density balers. We call them Hestons. If you kicked one, you'd actually hurt your feet because they're solid as a brick. and the average ones, we now use them at the farm. We don't have a Heston baler. We have a contractor come in, and they weigh upwards of 500 kilos, which is half a ton. And they're about a metre by a metre on each end, so 1,000 mil by 2.5 metres long, which is about 8 foot long. And they stack in the barn and take up less than half of the room that the round balers would do. And of course, they're so dense. If you did that density in a small conventional bale size, you just wouldn't be able to lift it by hand. It'd be well over 100 kilos.
So the thing is, Kathleen, Heston bales, that's just the name of a certain type of square bale.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but generally we call all those large ones Hestons, and they're held together with five or six very thick strings, not like conventional. It's almost rope, and the bales go along, and they can be wrapped at the back of the baler as well. It's the latest trend, and particularly with the round bales as well, you can actually wrap them with the baler going on at the same time. It's a fascinating process to watch, and that means you can bale your hay with it being slightly damp, and it's then called something completely different. It's called haylage. Yeah, have you scratched your head yet?
Because it's, you asked for it, Kathleen. Yeah, you've got it.
It's so complex. Yeah,
to but be, is it true that farmers use baling twine to keep their trousers up?
I wouldn't know. No, I've done worse. I suppose it's that image of a trouser being held up with baler twine around the top of your trouser legs to stop the mice running up when you're harvesting, and worst of all, a piece of straw or hay hanging out of your mouth, and of course accompanied by "get off my land."
None of which happens round here, I can tell you. So for any more questions and comments on our weekly podcast, please send emails to chris@highashfarm.com. You can also explore some of the images, photographs and videos in living colour that are provided on the High Ash Farm Facebook site. And the website is highashfarm.com/podcast if you want to look into supporting the running costs of this here production.
And I hope we'll have some High Ash fox cubs on there for this Sunday's podcast. The camera will go out again shortly and see if I can get some daylight footage of those very small little playful fox cubs that we have here at the farm.